2. Pyotr Stepanovich ran round to see his father twice, but unfortunately I was absent on both occasions. He visited him for the first time only on Wednesday, that is, not till the fourth day after their first meeting, and then only on business. Their difficulties over the property were settled, by the way, without fuss or publicity. Varvara Petrovna took it all on herself and paid all that was owing, taking over the land, of course, and only informed Stepan Trofimovitch that it was all settled, and her butler, Alexei Yegorich, was, by her authorization, bringing him something to sign. This Stepan Trofimovitch did in silence, with extreme dignity. Apropos of his dignity, I may mention that I hardly recognized my old friend during those days. He behaved as he had never done before, became amazingly taciturn, and had not even written one letter to Varvara Petrovna since Sunday, which seemed to me almost a miracle. What's more, he had become quite calm. He had fastened upon a final and decisive idea which gave him tranquillity. That was evident. He had hit upon this idea and sat still expecting something. At first, however, he was ill, especially on Monday. He had an attack of his summer cholera, and could not remain all that time without news either. But as soon as I departed from the statement of facts and began discussing the case in itself and formulated any theory, he at once gesticulated to me to stop. But both his interviews with his son had a distressing effect on him, though they did not shake his determination. After each interview, he spent the whole day lying on the sofa with a handkerchief soaked in vinegar on his head, but he continued to remain calm in the deepest sense. Sometimes, however, he did not hinder my speaking. Sometimes, too, it seemed to me that the mysterious determination he had taken seemed to be failing him, and he appeared to be struggling with a new, seductive stream of ideas. That was only at moments, but I made a note of it. I suspected that he was longing to assert himself again, to come forth from his seclusion, to show fight, to struggle to the last.
"Share! I could crush them!" broke from him on Thursday evening after his second interview with Pyotr Stepanovich, when he lay stretched on the sofa with his head wrapped in a towel. Till that moment he had not uttered one word all day. "Fies, fies, Share!" and so on. "I agree all those expressions are nonsense, kitchen talk, and so be it. I see it for myself. I never gave him food or drink. I sent him a tiny baby from Berlin to X-Province by post, and all that, I admit it. You gave me neither food nor drink and sent me by post," he says, "and what's more, you've robbed me here." "But you, unhappy boy," I cried to him, "my heart has been aching for you all my life, though I did send you by post, il rit. But I admit it. Granted, it was by post," he concluded, almost in delirium. "Passons," he began again 5 minutes later. "I don't understand Turgenev. That Basarov of his is a fictitious figure. It does not exist anywhere. The fellows themselves were the first to disown him as unlike anyone. That Bazarov is a sort of indistinct mixture of Nozdryov and Byron. C'est le mot. Look at them attentively. They caper about and squeal with joy like puppies in the sun. They are happy, they are victorious. What is there of Byron in them? And with that, such ordinariness. What a low-bred, irritable vanity. What an abject craving to faire de bruit autour de son nom, without noticing that son nom, oh, it's a caricature. Surely," I cried to him, "you don't want to offer yourself just as you are as a substitute for Christ? Il rit beaucoup, il rit trop. He has a strange smile. His mother had not a smile like that. Il rit toujours." Silence followed again. "They are cunning. They were acting in collusion on Sunday, he blurted out suddenly. Oh, not a doubt of it, I cried, pricking up my ears. It was a got-up thing, and it was too transparent, and so badly acted. I don't mean that. You know that it was all too transparent on purpose, that those who had to might understand it. Do you understand that? I don't understand. Tant mieux, passons. I am very irritable today.
But why have you been arguing with him, Stepan Trofimovitch? I asked him reproachfully.
Je voulais convertir. You laugh, of course. Cette pauvre auntie. Elle entendra des belles choses. Oh, my dear boy. Would you believe it? I felt like a patriot. I always recognized that I was a Russian. However, a genuine Russian must be like you and me. Il y a dedans quelque chose d'aveugle et de louche.
Not a doubt of it, I assented.
My dear, the real truth always sounds improbable. Do you know that? To make truth sound probable, you must always mix in some falsehood with it. Men have always done so. Perhaps there's something in it that passes our understanding. What do you think? Is there something we don't understand in that triumphant squeal? I should like to think there was. I should like to think so.
I did not speak. He, too, was silent for a long time.
They say that French cleverness, he babbled suddenly, as though in a fever. That's false. It always has been. Why libel French cleverness? It's simply Russian indolence, our degrading impotence to produce ideas, our revolting parasitism in the rank of nations. Ils sont tout simplement des parseurs, not French cleverness. Oh, the Russians ought to be extirpated for the good of humanity, like noxious parasites. We've been striving for something utterly, utterly different. I can make nothing of it. I have given up understanding. Do you understand, I cried to him, that if you have the guillotine in the foreground of your program and are so enthusiastic about it too, it's simply because nothing's easier than cutting off heads, and nothing's harder than to have an idea.
Vous êtes des paresseux. Votre drapeau est une guenille, une impuissance.
It's those carts, or what was it? The rumble of the carts carrying bread to humanity, being more important than the Sistine Madonna. Or, what's the saying?
Une bêtise sans ce genre.
Don't you understand? Don't you understand, I said to him, that unhappiness is just as necessary to man as happiness? Il rit. All you do is to make a bon mot, he said, with your limbs snug on a velvet sofa. He used a coarser expression. And this habit of addressing a father so familiarly is very nice when father and son are on good terms, but what do you think of it when they are abusing one another?
We were silent again for a minute.
Cher, he concluded at last, getting up quickly, do you know this is bound to end in something?
Of course, said I.
Vous ne comprenez pas, passons. But usually, in our world, things come to nothing. But this will end in something. It's bound to. It's bound to.
He got up and walked across the room in violent emotion, and coming back to the sofa, sank onto it, exhausted. On Friday morning, Pyotr Stepanovitch went off somewhere in the neighbourhood and remained away till Monday. I heard of his departure from Liputin, and in the course of conversation I learned that the Lebyadkins, brother and sister, had moved to the Riverside Quarter. I moved them, he added. And, dropping the Lebyadkins, he suddenly announced to me that Lizaveta Nikolaevna was going to marry Mavriky Nikolaevich, that, although it had not been announced, the engagement was a settled thing. Next day I met Lizaveta Nikolaevna out riding with Mavriky Nikolaevich. She was out for the first time after her illness. She beamed at me from the distance, laughed, and nodded in a very friendly way. I told all this to Stepan Trofimovitch. He paid no attention, except to the news about the Lebyadkins. And now, having described our enigmatic position throughout those 8 days during which we knew nothing, I will pass on to the description of the succeeding events of my chronicle, writing, so to say, with full knowledge, and describing things as they became known afterwards, and are clearly seen today. I will begin with the 8th day after that Sunday, that is, the Monday evening, for in reality, a new scandal began with that evening.